2FM.
Thanks to the two Johnnies, it's Tuesday the 14th of March and this is Game On. Coming up today, we'll cross to Rugby in Cheltenham. Honeysuckle signs off in style.
Round the bend they come to the final flight. Honeysuckle's every chance of a fairy tale farewell here. Trying to draw alongside Love Envoy. They've quickened again now. Down towards the last. Honeysuckle out jumped by Love Envoy. He's got a slender lead. Love Envoy hanging slightly. Here comes Honeysuckle to raise the roof. Her final run. She's going to go out a winner again. Honeysuckle has done it to beat Love Envoy. What a way to go out. Fairy tale stuff from a magnificent race mare.
In soccer, Mark Langdon sets us up for the Champions League week ahead as Man City need a result and Liverpool need a miracle. In rugby, we'll get the views from the English rugby media ahead of Ireland's final Grand Slam hurdle. Plus, in Gaelic games, Damien Lawler outlines the remarkable growth of Kildare hurling and you remember the late Ian Kearns. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
Game On 2FM.
Now, welcome along. So day one at Cheltenham is done. Constitution Hill underlined his undoubted class in the champion hurdle and Honeysuckle delivered a fairy tale ending in the mayor's hurdle. Now we are going to be checking in with Ruby, but before we hear from him, let's get the closing stages of Honeysuckle's win today.
Round the bend they come to the final flight. Honeysuckle's every chance of a fairy tale farewell here. Trying to draw alongside Love Envoy. They've quickened again now. Down towards the last. Honeysuckle out jumped by Love Envoy. He's got a slender lead. Love Envoy hanging slightly. Here comes Honeysuckle to raise the roof. Her final run. She's going to go out a winner again. Honeysuckle has done it to beat Love Envoy. What a way to go out. Fairy tale stuff from a magnificent race mare.
Yeah, look, we all wish a very special kid could be here today, but he's watching down us. Oh God, it's a happiness. She was unbelievable. She's just, the way Henry has produced her every day is phenomenal. Like I just, as a jockey, I'm so grateful. Yeah, she's just a phenomenal mare. She's been incredible for my career. For everyone down in Knockeen who I've looked after over the years. Henry's head lad, Davy Roche, does an unbelievable job with all the horses. And yeah, she's just a credit to everyone. Kenny's one of the coolest owners you'll ever ride for. And yeah, it's a brilliant day.
I'm sure it's the fairy tale ending, isn't it? You know? Well, I presume it's the ending. There's always punches down, and Maloney will never let us get away with that. So it's the fairy tale ending. It's what you dream of happening, and you know, more often than not, it doesn't. But today it has, so it's incredible. Yeah, absolutely. It means a lot to all of us.
And how would you sum up what Honeysuckle has done?
Oh, she's, you know what I, you know, she's just an incredible mare. She's awesome. And yeah, look, we've had so much fun with her. Yeah, very lucky to have had her.
Yeah, that was Henry Bramhead speaking after Honeysuckle won the Mayor's Hurdle a little bit earlier on. Ruby Walsh joins us now. Ruby, it's one of those days that I'd say you're going to remember forever.
It is, Marie. It's one of those days like that you could always say, yeah, I was there, I watched that, I saw that. That's what it means to me. Now, I know it's horse racing and it won't have that sort of emotion for everybody, but it most certainly did for me to be here this afternoon to watch from start to finish. But to put the cherry on the cake, to watch Honeysuckle win with Rachel Blackmore, with everything that has gone on in the lives of the Bromheads this year, it was just, sport doesn't often deliver a fairy tale result, but by God, in Cheltenham we got every fairy tale this afternoon.
Yeah, it was amazing. And Ruby, like, I know you said there that not everybody was there or maybe understand, but even sitting at home on the television and watching it, every bit of that emotion came through the screen, and that does not always happen. But just the way it finished, Rachel's interview afterwards, the scenes and the parade ring, all that sort of stuff, like, it just, it felt magic. It must have just felt unreal over there.
It did, but I think, Marie, why everybody could relate to it is, I'm a parent, you're a parent, and there are loads of parents listening to this show, and no one of us wants to be where Heather and Henry the Bromhead are. So to stand here this afternoon and then watch Honeysuckle do that, and to see some bit of joy come into their lives only for a few moments, Like you couldn't have bought it. It was just and everybody felt it for them. Everybody was so happy for them and for me and Georgia. You couldn't, it's so hard to even put words on it. It was just the absolute fairy tale.
Yeah, and look, I often quote you on this. You always say that sport can be a great distraction for reality, and it actually really just felt like that, because to be able to have that unbridled joy at something and to be able to forget everything else that's going on in the world and around you and just be able to live in the moment is sometimes exactly what everybody needs. And you could see that in Henry and in Rachel as well, and just in everybody connected to them.
You could. And look, I know Henry a long time. I rode for him. Actually, my wife Gillian would know him a lot better. She would have been family friends with the Bromheads from the time she was a child. And like, I would know the Bromheads more socially than I would have even through riding. And to watch Henry today in the Winners' Enclosure, like, as Robert Power says, he thinks he's Jurgen Klopp. The reaction, the interaction he had with the crowd. Yeah, he could feel that. He could feel the warmth from the crowd, and he embraced it, and it was beautiful.
It was really powerful, actually. Now, like, and I was only just watching it on the television, but like what he was getting off the crowd, you could really sense it. What about Rachel, though, Ruby? Like, you never see her like that.
No, and look, maybe I'm speaking out of school here, but yesterday we were here in Cheltenham, and Rachel was doing some work for Jockey Club, and she was involved with a whole lot of kids in the local area, whatever. And I had not tagged on. I at the very end was involved in a photograph. So when the photographs were over, she rang my phone. I was thinking she was just in front of me 5 minutes ago, and listen, she rings. She says, "Where are you?" I said, "I'm still here." So yeah, she called me over. So she said she wanted to talk about the Mayor's Hurdle, and she was. How was she? I had never saw her as, I wouldn't say nervous, as anxious, as anxious is the word. And she was so anxious, and she wanted to talk through the race. And she just, it wasn't that she was looking for advice, she just wanted to talk and talk racing and talk every aspect of how this race would play out for her. And I just stood and was listening and offered a bit of advice here and a bit of advice there. But to see the pressure she was under and the pressure she had herself under yesterday, and then to see her deliver the ride she gave it, and because of the emotion and what happened, the actual technical skill of what she did will get overlooked. But she gave Honeysuckle a brilliant ride. She allowed Johnny Burke to lead. She sat and from second place, she controlled the whole race. They went really slow, and she kept all the opposition behind her. When they went to Challenger at the top of the hill, she just did enough to stay in front of them without committing herself. She did so many things right. And like, you always talk about big sports people and great triumphs, but you have to deliver on the big day. And this afternoon, Rachel Blackmore delivered perfectly when it mattered most.
Yeah, I was wondering about that, all right, because obviously I wouldn't have a clue what's going on, but whereas you would. But to be able to execute what she was able to execute under that pressure, Ruby, for you who's done it so many times, it must be just remarkable.
It'll make you admire her even more. And like, so much of horse racing is like every other sport. It's all about tactics. And people get hung up in the physical power and the physical ability of everybody that's involved in it. But if you can read a soccer match and you can be ahead of where the ball is going, whether you're technically as good as another player, it doesn't matter, because you're already ahead of them. I watch great sports people at the moment, Marie, and I admire them. You watch Keane Lynch, who always seems to have more time on the ball than anybody else. Davy Clifford the same. Messi had it. They just never seem to be in the wrong place. I often read it about Paul McGrath, whose athletic ability diminished, but his brain always kept him way ahead of the game. So much of sport is about how you think about it and how you execute it from a tactical point of view. You watch DuPont at the weekend. I mean, imagine having his foresight of what he did with the rugby ball. But you watch Rachel this afternoon, and it was her execution of the tactics that I admired so much, and it was magical to watch.
Especially because you knew the pressure she was under. Afterwards, Henry de Bromhead was joking about whether or not that was the end for Honeysuckle, but you'd imagine it is, Ruby.
I could see where Henry was coming from, to tell you the truth. Kenny Alexander, Honeysuckle's owner, he's not a breeder, he's a racehorse owner. And, you know, she's come down in division. found her form. I could see Henry's argument. For one, as a fan of the sport, I hope Henry gets his way. I hope he brings her on to Punchestown. That's what we want to see. I mean, we see it so much on the flat, where stallions have such a value, or three-year-old colts have such a value as stallions, and they go off to stud, and we never get to see their full potential. Why not see Honeysuckle once more? I hope Henry gets his way.
Okay, right, we'll be watching that space. Look, it was actually a brilliant day, Ruby, I have to say. I can only imagine what it was like over there, but just sitting and...
Did you enjoy it, Marie, did you?
I really did, yeah. Yeah, I had the kids and all watching just so they could see you. But anyway,
That wasn't that entertaining.
Constitution Hill, you had told me about how great Constitution Hill was, and I was saying to the boys, I was like, that horse is like Messi or Usain Bolt and all the rest. And then when I saw him race, I actually got it. But for someone like you who knows racing inside and out, Ruby, it must have just been fantastic to watch a horse of that caliber and know that it's only just getting going.
I know, but it's what every sport needs. I mean, football is lucky to have, or it had Dublin for a couple of years. It has Kerry and Davy Clifford now. Hurling has Limerick. Every sport needs superstars. Mm-hmm. And in racing, you need superstar race horses. And Constitution Hill looks to be that. He is brilliant. Now, I, probably not being a pessimist, but being a realist, understand that he has to stay sound and do that again in 2024 and again in 2025, and that's how you build a rapport, how people come to fall in love with a horse and admire what they're doing. It's about longevity. I just hope Constitution Hill has the good fortune of staying sound. Even though he's trained in the UK and it's not wonderful for Ireland, I suppose, but for the sport as a whole, because National Hunt Race in Marie between Ireland and England, it shouldn't really be. The divide is the Irish Sea, but they're the one product. Mm-hmm. They're the same horses running against each other. And, you know, I hope Constitution Hill can stay sound enough to become a great, an all-time great, like Istabrak, like Cawdor Star. He's brilliant, but he has to have longevity to become great.
Yeah, and, in fairness to Nico de Boinville as well, you know, he was quite relaxed about the whole thing as well. You know, he wasn't building up the hype. How good of a job did he do?
He kept it so simple, and that's what Nico de Boinville does. And look, Nico wouldn't be popular with every punter or every racing fan, but for me, looking at it from a pundit's point of view, or looking at it tactically, Nico de Boinville wins on every horse that should win. I'm not saying he wins on the ones that shouldn't, but you put Nico de Boinville on the best horse and he doesn't make a mistake. He keeps it so simple. Pressure doesn't seem to get to him. It doesn't seem to faze him. He just delivers. And like to go down to the start in a champion hurdle, a horse like Constitution Hill, so short in the betting, knowing that the 68 or 70,000 people that are here in Cheltenham are here to watch you. And he just, it doesn't seem to bother him.
Yeah, no, he was called the Iceman after it or something like that, in those words anyway, and he did nothing seem to faze him or bother him. Let's go back to the start of the day, Ruby, the Supreme, and I know that you had great hopes for Fasa Vega, but it was Marine National who did the job there, and another great story, Mikey O'Sullivan, the... pretty much a novice jockey almost, you know, just getting going, and what a great ride he gave Marine National.
He did. He gave him a brilliant ride, followed Fasile Vega every step of the way, rode him with unbelievable confidence. Now, Barry Connolly's trainer had unwavering confidence in him, mm-hmm. but that doesn't make a horse win. But Mikey, who ended up riding a double, he won the Fred Bootle's Fred Winter on Jazzy Matty. He was unbelievably cool on this horse. He's only a young jockey. He's from Cork. He turned professional during the summer. He's a claimer. Actually, he was at a £3 disadvantage in that race because in a Grade 1, he can't use his allowance. But he was so cool and calculated, and he was brilliant on Jazzy Matty for Gordon Elliott in the second last race, Marie. And actually, just, I know, look, we might as well spill the beans. This is recorded, folks. just because we were coming on air, John McConnell looked like training his first Cheltenham winner, Marie, when Mahler Misham, who was clear, fell at the second last fence and left the race at the mercy of Patrick Mullins and Gaillard de Menil for Willie Mullins to give him a second winner on the day. But not everything was up this afternoon. It was a disappointing day for John McConnell, but I'm sure he'll get another chance.
Yeah, I hope so anyway. And you mentioned Willie Mullins there, the Arkell, El Fabiolo, Paul Townend. Great to get that win anyway, that early win for Willie.
Ah, it was, and good for Paul as well. They gave him a very confident ride. He waited for the split off the home turn. Dysart Dynamo rolled a bit wide off the bend, and Paul did just grab the opportunity with two hands, shot through on El Fabiolo, and he was a good winner. His jumping is only okay, but he has found a way of getting from A to B and staying upright. And, you know, I suppose, like anybody, kicking an early penalty or getting an early free, it was a nervous settler for Paul Townend, and it should set him up for a great three more days to come.
So we do have three more days to come, Ruby. Tomorrow, what are you looking forward to?
I'm looking forward to Imperé Pass in the first, Jerry Colomb in the second, Captain Comby in the third. I think Edgerstone could win the fourth. The fifth will be Delta Work. The sixth is the plate. No massive opinion on that. In fact, the file in the bumper, Marie. That's what I'm looking forward to tomorrow. It'll be another great day, but I have a funny feeling there's no way it's going to top this afternoon.
Yeah, it was really special. Did you have a chat with Rachel? Did she say, "I told you so," after she was on last week and you thought that Honeysuckle wasn't going to win?
She did.
I'm glad. If nothing else happens now for the rest of the week, and I'm happy.
Do you want to just text me?
You know what, Marie? I was never as happy to be wrong.
I'd say, and to be fair, you did say that. So look, Ruby, thanks a million. I know you're so busy. Thanks for giving us the time, and we'll be chatting to you again tomorrow. Enjoy the evening and enjoy tomorrow.
No, you won't. I'll be talking to Shane tomorrow.
Yeah, I mean, I might be sending the odd WhatsApp voice note. That's about it.
Cheers. Good luck.
Bye. Game on 2FM. Welcome back. It is time to turn our attention to hurling, to Kildare hurling to be very specific, and the rising tide in the county there. Damien Lawler joins us on the line now. Damien, how are you?
Marie, I'm in great form. How are you getting on?
Sure, grand. Yeah, good day watching Cheltenham, so nothing to complain about. I'm very interested, though, in what's happening in Kildare hurling. And Damien, you've been writing about this for quite a long time now, so it would be of no surprise to you just how well everything is going there. But I think maybe this weekend, beating Kerry, and just the last few months, really, just how well everything has been going has caught the attention of maybe the wider hurling public. But you might just give us a little bit of context, Damien, on what's been going on in Kildare.
Well, you're 100% right. I have been writing about it for a long time, but I've never just did a piece there last week, Marie, before they played Kerry in the Allianz League Division 2A. And do you know yourself, sometimes articles just stick and people come back and text you, and I wouldn't have expected that at all. And it just shows that people are now aware of maybe where Kildare are at in the hierarchy and maybe where they could get to. So is it maybe there was a period way back in the 1970s Kildare got to four National Hurling League quarterfinals, and they met my own county in Tip, like maybe all 4 years, but certainly three. But in the last 2 years, Marie, they only lost by 6 points and they lost by 7 points. Soon after then, they got a draw with Offaly in 75 in the Leinster Senior Hurling Championship. In 76, I think, they beat Dublin in the province, and then Ard Cloc went on to beat Buffers Alley in the Leinster Club Championship. But really, I suppose at that level, it never really went any higher than that. And now you probably had a situation that I suppose everybody would be aware, not everybody, a lot of people would be aware of the work that's gone into places like Naas and that over the past decade, 15 years. Kildare beat Wexford in the under 20 Leinster a couple of years ago. They won two Christy rings in the last few seasons. This year they started off, they won the Hugh Cup pre-season. They're top of Division 2 of the Allianz Hurling League. They played Kerry last weekend, and next time up is Offaly. They're guaranteed a semi-final spot in 2A, but if they beat Offaly, they can secure a league final spot and possibly go on to get promotion to top flight hurling for the first time in their history. So they're unbeaten so far. They don't have Jack Sheridan involved this season so far, and yet they're absolutely... How will I say? It's still only March, Marie, and I'm very, very wary of maybe overhyping it. But what they've done over the past couple of seasons, this is David Herity's fourth year in charge, and what they've done is to fundamentally build and build and build. Naas went on to win the All-Ireland Intermediate Senior Championship. Mm-hmm. They ran Ballyhale fairly well in the Leinster Senior Championship this year. But more than that, it's Naas CBS. It's the likes of Maynooth, Ard Cloc, Aero Coracle, Selbridge. Like the under-14 panel last year had 21 clubs involved out of the 25 hurling clubs that are in the county. This year's Kildare Minors have 13 clubs. If you only go back 4 or 5 years ago, Marie, there might only be 4 or 5 clubs involved. In this year's Minor Hurling League, there are 14 teams playing in Kildare. And clubs like Round Towers in Kildare Town, people like Paul Condon, who's a Waterford man living up in Kildare now, driving it on, trying to develop the small ball game, trying to get profile hurlers from all over the country to come and meet them. The likes of Kappa are working hard underage. 2 Mile Horse began a couple of years ago. They're up to minor now. Can these clubs go forward and field adult teams? You know, that'll build on as well, Marie. There was a hurling action plan started in 2018. Looked at club development, look at building links between clubs and schools, building hurling's profile. And all of that is adding up. And I was in Newbridge last week to watch Kildare play Kerry. The music was blaring. There was kids everywhere. They were poking around. There was specially made posters for children to get signed afterwards. So they're doing all the right things on and off the field. I can't see the work rate stopping over the next few years. How far they go is a different thing, Marie. I couldn't answer that. It would be fantastic to see them winning the Joe McDonagh Cup and getting up to the Mon Hurling. That might be a little bit off just yet. You know, you just don't know.
I think you nailed it there, Damien, when you said that the work is going to continue, because it does sound like a huge amount of work has gone in over many years and across the board, from schools to clubs. And they having the foresight and kind of that joined up thinking. I know that in St Jude's in Dublin, we've played Naas a few times, so they obviously play in our league. I know there's teams that play in the Kilkenny League as well, the championships. How beneficial has things like that been as well?
Absolutely, absolutely massive, Marie. And like, I just give you an example. My young lad is same age as your little fella. He's 11 and playing under 12. Now, unfortunately for me, soccer would be probably his number one, maybe a bit like Timmy as well, but Gaelic football would be his number two and hurling would be his number three. But if he decides to apply himself to hurling in Naas, the opportunities are endless for the club in terms of for the facilities that they provide for youngsters. They go, like, so Jamie Seen went down to play Kilkenny in one of the blitzes down there to play in Wexford, and they can now go anywhere in Ireland and hold their own and expect to perform very, very well. And they're disappointed if they don't do really well. And what I've noticed, even from being involved at underage Camogie with my daughter Chloe, a couple of years ago, maybe you might have had a march on certain clubs. You don't have a march anymore. The likes of Selbridge, Maynooth, Arklok, you know, they're really working hard and to even get past the level that Naas are at. So it's certainly not just one club. It is very much spread around the county. And I was involved a little bit this year with Naas CBS. We got to the Leinster semi-final of the B competition, and it effectively took Skull Cormac, which is 5 or 6 Offaly minors, and they probably would have played with the Offaly schools team in the A competition. It effectively took a team like that to beat us in the semi-final. And young Keen Boren was playing in that game. A great, great player. I think he got 2 goals on the night against Skull Cormac. He's playing with the Kildare senior team already. David Herity's brought him in. So, you know probably David Herity as well as I do, Marie. Work rate is the first port of call there. And then the likes of James Burke, Brian Byrne, and Niall Winnicon got on the team of the week this week at the GEA for his performances. And they play Offaly next week. And, you know, they're trying to keep themselves grounded now all week. But it's just working, working, working. People like Joe Quaid have come in previously and done very, very well. But Herity is in his 4th season. I think he's another year or 2 left. And I think the longer that they can keep that marriage between Herity and Kildare hurling going, the better. And I think that whoever replaces David in a few years' time will be a high-profile person, because I feel that there's a lot to aim for now, you know, both at club level. And I suppose hurling is now in the county. It may not always be the first choice, but maybe for youngsters coming through, they have a proper choice now, Marie.
It's just so interesting following it, Damien, because a lot of people would be under the perception, you know, that you can't create a hurling culture in a county that doesn't have the tradition. But it just shows that you absolutely can, and that can be replicated in clubs all around the country. But the one thing that I noticed from watching them and seeing Naas play an underage level is they seem to have a real focus on the skill set. And it's the simplest thing, but if you can get that right, Damien, you can go anywhere.
Get it right. And I think that, you know, you can build a culture, first of all. Mm-hmm. How far it'll bring you, I don't know. I mean, it won't be long now before Kildare will be leading proper support from Croke Park.
Yeah.
A bit like Westmeath and Carlow in the end. But what it is really is the people involved. Like, I mean, I go back to Naas, where there's a guy called John Holmes working hard at producing players from under four to under six for the last 30 years. And he started off trying to have PlayStations as prizes to get the players out to train. And Naas won the All-Ireland Intermediate title last year. 35 of the panel went through John Holmes' nursery. Wow. And you go anywhere in the club and the hurling people will leap out and try and bring you in and try and get you to help. And I'm only talking about Naas because I'm involved with Naas. It's the same in the other hurling spots around the county. There's more kind of blitzes and leagues being held. There's opportunities for Kildare teams maybe to play in Dublin and play down in Kilkenny. So they have gone in search of higher challenges. They have gone in search of higher intensity. Whereas you were saying, if you have the skills and you can find that higher intensity against the Kilkenny clubs, you're going to educate yourself all the way up along the ladder. And be it a Kilmacud Crokes team, they'll go neck and neck with them as well. But I think it's all happening at club. It's all happening at schools level. It needs probably a little bit more attention there. But all I'm saying is really, if you're in Kildare now and you're a youngster starting off between camogie or hurling, it is a viable option now rather than just automatically reverting to the football. They are going up through the levels, and I don't think anybody's getting too carried away. I think it's a precious thing what they're aiming for, and it's a precious thing what they've worked so hard to try and cultivate. I don't think it could slip away with a defeat or two, but the slightest little knock at that level, Marie, you're still very vulnerable beneath the scenes, whereas a team like maybe a traditional county can take a few knocks. You need everything going for you in counties like Kildare, where you are trying to make a breakthrough, and you've seen it with Cheddar in Laois, and you've mm-hmm. seen it with Westmeath, and you've seen it with Carlow and Antrim. They've looked great at times, but maybe they come trickling back down again. And I believe more sustained support is needed in terms of resources and in terms of personnel. Maybe if Kildare do go to the next level, which is possible, Marie. It is possible.
We've heard Don Logue, Cusack, over the last little while calling for more resources. There probably is conversations happening around the country about hurling and what it needs and how it can grow and develop. Liam Griffin had that motion at Congress that didn't get through. But
it's just a shame.
Yeah, like, is there concerns, Damien, really, just kind of when we look at hurling and where it's at, and maybe the fact that, look, some counties have knocked on the door. They've knocked on the door and haven't been able to push it open and gone away. And maybe now the next wave, Kildare are leading it. But do we need somebody to actually make that breakthrough to show what can be done?
The breakthrough is such... There's such a gulf between 2A and 1B. There's such a gulf between the Joe McDonagh and the Liam McCarthy. I do believe you need to be protected almost for 5 years to try and let you find your way. Even counties like Meath, you can see the work that they're putting in underage, Marie, and their population there as well. Like, there's 250,000 people in Kildare now. It's nearly 250,000. And there's no reason why it can't be sustained. But they're going to need extra games development administrators. They're going to need extra work in schools. They're going to need extra money. And money won't solve everything, but it'll go a long way towards helping. And I think clubs, you know, need to be sustained as well with all the coaching programs that are out there, because otherwise they will just slip away. And that is a worry. But I will say one thing. A few years ago, two Kenny brothers from Selbridge, Niall and Connor, you know, unbelievable hurlers up here. Connor would have been the best hurler in Kildare, but they moved back to Tipperary, and Connor especially made great strides. He made the Tipperary panel, played several league games, maybe just a little bit off the top level intensity. But now, if that situation was rising now, would players like the Kennys, whose dad Philip is from Bursalee anyway, and they have extremely close links to the county, but all I'm saying now is you might think twice now about having to make a move like that. And that's certainly the next step on the ladder for Kildare, if they got to Division 1, to test themselves then. Underage, they have beaten the likes of Wexford and beaten the likes of Carlow, beaten the likes of Laois, beaten the likes of Offaly. So they are making progress. But you need to be protected for 5 years, I think, without relegation affecting you. You need increased funding. You need increased coaching as well. And you need to try and maybe broaden out your club championship so that your structures are actually improving domestically themselves and that they can sustain improvement going forward. Because I think you look at all the coaching money Dublin got over the years, Marie, well, a fraction of that would be colossal for Kildare hurling. And indeed, a fraction of that would be colossal for Antrim hurling as well. But I do believe Kildare are putting their hand up. I do believe that they are the nearest to the chasing pack that's in the Lee McCarthy Cup. And it'll be interesting to see how their next couple of games go. And then again, they meet Kerry in the Joe McDonagh Cup in a few weeks' time. And I know Kerry will be all out to reverse that result of last weekend too. But they're certainly put themselves in the frame for things anyway. And it's only through hard work and sticking at it.
Yeah, it just takes time. Damien, before we finish up, there's a couple of other things I want to get to. And one of them is Seamus Cannon.
Yeah.
And wondering, have you got an update on how he is after the weekend?
Yeah, so went off with maybe, it's suspected medial ligament damage, Marie, according to the local newspaper, the Nina Guardian, and that might keep Seamus out for 6 to 8 weeks. So he's definitely in a race against time for the start of the Munster Championship. It's a big loss because Seamus would have worked exceptionally hard, you know, to overcome injuries in the last couple of seasons to get himself back right and fit to be in a position to challenge for his place in the team. And it looks like now he joins a fairly lengthy injury list. You know, like the likes of Cathal Barrett, the likes of Niall O'Mara, so there's Paddy Goodell is out for the year, unfortunately, as well. But yeah, there's plenty of injuries for Tipperary to contend with, and he's just the latest in a number, Marie.
Okay, Damien Lawler, as always, thank you so much for your insight and company, and we will talk to you again very, very soon. We're going to take a quick break, but do stay with us. Plenty more to come, including a Champions League preview and the view from the English media ahead of Saturday's huge rugby game. Well, welcome back. It is time to turn our attention to rugby and get the view of the English media ahead of Ireland's huge game against England at the weekend. I'm delighted to say that Ben Coles, rugby reporter with The Telegraph, joins us now. Ben, how are you?
Yeah, good. Thanks. Hope you're well.
Thanks so much for joining us. Look, it's been a few days now since the defeat to France. How have things settled down and what's the take now?
Yeah, really interesting week. England have just released a squad update. They're just trying to finalise who's going to be playing this weekend. So there's a slightly larger England squad for the rest of the week than we'd normally have. They normally cut down to about 26, 25 players on a Tuesday, but instead they've named about 30. So there's no Premiership game, so they have more players available. Yeah, I think they're just trying to pick up the pieces a bit, really, and sort of make sense of what happened, because it was quite an extraordinary day. And I think it's fair to say they're not going to lose by 43 points again, probably. But it was just so much to sort of process after a defeat like that. But yeah, you have to feel sorry for the coaching staff and the players.
Yeah, you will. And look, I suppose there was a huge amount of focus running into the game, and there has been a huge amount of focus on Steve Borthwick since the Eddie Jones departure, and he stepped in. What do you think is going to have worried him most or even hurt him most after that display against France?
I think in the short term you're concerned because there isn't a lot of time to fix things ahead of travelling to face the number one side in the world, having just been resoundingly beaten by the number two side. So I think his work is certainly cut out for him. In the long run, that game actually might prove to be quite beneficial in terms of working out which players are going to be part of this setup moving forward, both through to the World Cup and beyond the World Cup ahead of 2023, because obviously Borthwick's on a long contract and he's sort of got to assess who's going to be the right players for him in the short term as well as the long term. So I think it's going to be quite interesting in the long run which players he may have, when he's gone back through the tape, may have thought, actually, I'm not sure if you're the right fit necessarily for what we're looking for moving forward. It's such a tricky position, but then it was always going to be ever since he was appointed replacing Eddie Jones in December, because he was given only a few test matches to really get his handle on the team ahead of the World Cup. And so there's definitely, I think, if say that had been Eddie Jones in charge and that performance and defeat had happened, then I think we know what the reaction would have been. Mm-hmm. I think because it's Steve Borthwick and he's come in on a fairly short-term basis, there's maybe a bit more sympathy towards him. And actually, Marcus Smith described the game in Dublin this week as a free swing for England, which I think maybe is an insight into what they're trying to just sort of, you know, just process it, see what's going to work this weekend and perhaps just kind of have a look to the future in terms of developing some systems.
Yeah, just on the systems, I know Borthwick was saying afterwards that the plan didn't work. I'm not sure if it was very evident what the plan was, but do you envision that they will come up with a new plan now for the Ireland game?
That's a good question, because the plan seemed to be, when we spoke to England last week, that they wanted to play at tempo. They wanted to try and keep France's big physical pack moving, try and tire them out, and then hopefully get an advantage by sort of wearing them down and build points on the scoreboard that way. Whereas actually what happened, everything sort of related to plans and selection of Marcus Smith at fly half and all of that kind of went out the window, because they were just beaten up front. And I think that's what will hurt the players personally in terms of their own pride, because they'll know that actually in those physical confrontations, not necessarily the scrum and the lineup, because actually England were kind of competent in those areas. It's more just the physical sort of breakdown, the contact area. They just weren't able to create any possession and any sort of flow to allow Smith and the backs to thrive. And I think therefore the idea of systems kind of went out the window. And there is a defensive issue clearly, because they are conceding tries at a phenomenal rate. That probably comes from trying to switch your defensive system so late in the World Cup cycle. But yeah, I think that's not the most tries England have ever conceded in a Six Nations Championship, which is a fairly damning statistic with one round to go, to be honest.
Nobody likes those kind of records. Just on the physicality, and it's getting quite a lot of attention here, the lack of it. And I think it's because when you're playing a rival in your home ground and you have a new coach, you'd expect there to be a bit more of that. And it just didn't seem to come from anywhere within that England team. What, could you explain why that was, or could the coaching staff or the players themselves explain why there was that lack of physicality and intensity?
Not in the immediate aftermath. I think they were actually pretty surprised. They'd gone in not necessarily confident, but they felt they'd had the selection sort of correct, that everything in the week had been perfect. I think what was quite interesting was we got a chance to speak to Francois Cross, the France flanker, afterwards about, and we asked, you know, Steve Borthwick said that you've been physically so much better than England. Why is that? And he actually said that the reason France was so impressive from a physical perspective was because the French media, after the defeat to Ireland, had basically suggested that France were lacking in that area, and therefore that the display against England was kind of a riposte in a way to sort of prove that France could play physically. So actually Ireland are to blame, I think. Ireland basically revved up France to such an extent, or rather revved up such a reaction back home in France after that defeat, that actually France wanted to make a bit of a statement. And we've seen France play some amazing rugby in this World Cup cycle. I think that is as close to perfection as you're going to get. And actually, if you're thinking big picture, they probably delivered that performance a little bit early, because you want to save it for the latter rounds of the Rugby World Cup later this year at home. But they were just sublime. No wonder Fabien Gauthier was in tears. I think honestly, on the day, France were just 10 times better physically, and it all came down to sort of mindset. England just couldn't cope with it.
And just in terms of the selection, which did, I guess, look, Marcus Smith did get a lot of focus heading into the game. For this game now coming up, do you expect there to be many changes? Like, will there be a bit of pressure on Borthwick to change, or equal amount of pressure for him to show loyalty?
Yeah, that's tricky, because I'm not sure there's quite the depth available in certain positions for England to think about making a big change. And I think what we might see is, we might see Owen Farrell come back into the starting 15 at fly half. We might see the return of Manu Tuilagi at inside centre. Tuilagi would be interesting, because he's just coming back from a three-match ban for a dangerous tackle against Southampton Saints. Wasn't included by England in the first couple of games, despite and being available, which is the first time really that he's kind of been dropped. That has a good record against Ireland. I know in the 2019 game in particular, he was excellent, but he hasn't played a lot. So that's interesting. But then England seemed to feel like they need a bit more power, or that the power wasn't there against France. So I think Tuilagi coming back is possible. And Ollie Chesson, the young second row, who's had a pretty decent Six Nations, has been ruled out through injury. So Johnny Hill might come back at lock. I think it, basically England are trying to now figure out how to add a bit more bulk and a bit more power to that pack, and that might mean that we see a second row use of blindside flanker, so we could see Mara Tojo there, George Martin from Leicester's being called up. I think that will be the focus this week. How can we get more power into the side? How can we sort of hang in there really with Ireland in that area, and then hopefully try and get a bit more control of our kicking game? Because I think without being able to handle what Ireland can do up front, then it's going to be very difficult for England to cause an upset.
So for the weekend, there's a huge amount of expectation on this Ireland team. you could go as far as saying that, you know, we're nearly planning the party already, which is never a good thing in sport. Do you think that England can come over here and spoil the Irish party on Saturday?
I would say there is a real outside chance. I think Ireland have had moments in this Six Nations where they've really been tested, when it was 2024 against Italy, when they were, you know, the first half against Scotland with all those injuries. I think actually the way Ireland came through that first half against Scotland, it will be of enormous benefit, not just for this game, but in the build-up to the World Cup, proving that they can handle that adversity. So I feel like Ireland are certainly favourites, and I've seen sort of reports that they're, you know, favourites to win by about 14, 15 points. I don't think that's crazy, given the place that England are in after last week and the transition they're going through. But I guess it would be incredibly foolish to completely write England off. But yeah, I think it's fair enough to be. I think it's fair enough to be planning the celebrations and the party. Yeah, no, I think you're on safe ground there.
And then just to look ahead a little bit, look, I guess because Ireland are the number one team in the world, and like as you said, they came through that Scotland test. They've been so impressive in the Six Nations so far. When things went wrong against Scotland, they were able to replace players, they were able to adapt. So we are kind of looking ahead now to a World Cup, and we do have a huge amount of expectation now put on this team. And, you know, there's excitement as well, but still there's a huge amount of concern because we have been in this position before where we, you know, it seemed like all the signs are pointing towards a brilliant Rugby World Cup and the wheels came off. Just in terms of where Ireland are at, and obviously Ben having followed and been writing about and reporting on rugby for quite some time, would you think that this could be a year where Ireland do progress to pretty far, well, as far as we've ever done in a Rugby World Cup?
I think it's time, isn't it?
Yes.
I think the way they've been playing, the performances in New Zealand last summer, the fact that they are quite clearly, you know, fully deserving of that number one status in the world, I think it is time. I mean, equally, it's a tricky group, and that comes back to this argument we've had recently about when should you be deciding who's in which pool for the Rugby World Cup. Ireland being in a pool with South Africa and Scotland doesn't seem particularly fair, particularly when you look at England at the moment, and England's where they're there with Argentina and Japan, potentially a quarterfinal against Australia, and all of a sudden an England team that no one really fancies that much is suddenly in the semi-finals. But I do think with what's impressed us most about Ireland specifically is the depth available, the players who are able to come in and sort of deliver performances where the standard doesn't dip. The depth, particularly in positions like in the midfield and the scrum half, I think is, and in the back row, is just extraordinary. Like other nations would absolutely be able to have some of those players available to them. So, yeah, in short, it's time. I think it's time for Ireland to go further and actually, yeah, to certainly win that group and then start thinking big.
Wouldn't it be interesting if that happened with Andy Farrell at the helm?
It would be, yeah. And I mean, there's been some interesting talk this week about when the RFU mad to let Andy Farrell go. I mean, I think that's sort of a bit short-sighted because at the time when England's 2015 campaign fell apart, there was nothing else. The reset button was the only thing that was going to be pressed. I mean, it sort of had to happen. But I think it's been so impressive the way he's sort of developed as a coach, what he's done with Ireland, how he's taken Ireland on since 2019, taking over from Joe Schmidt. Yeah, look, he's quite clearly a fantastic coach, and there's, you know, a British and Irish Lions tour on the horizon as well, and he's clearly the top name at the moment in the frame for that based on what he's achieved.
Yeah, well, the right guy at the right time, so hopefully anyway it'll keep moving in the right direction as well. Ben Coles, thank you so much for joining us. Are you coming over at the weekend?
Sadly not. I've got a 7-week-old baby boy at home who I'll be sort of keeping an eye on and trying to do analysis at the same time. So yeah.
Well, congratulations on that, and best of luck with the multitasking. Talk to you soon, Ben. We're going to take a very quick break now. We have Champions League to come.
Game on 2FM.
Now it is time to turn our attention to football. I'm delighted to say that Fergal Brennan is with me now on the line. Fergal, how are you?
Very good. And yourself?
Sure, looking forward to all the Champions League. But before we get to that, though, I want to talk to you about the World Cup. I'm still looking back at the one that was only on a few months ago and thinking, wasn't that such an enjoyable World Cup? Why would you mess with it? Why would you change it? Well, of course, they're going to do that. So the 2026 World Cup finals, which are going to be on in the United States, Canada and Mexico, are going to feature 104 games, a new round of 32 stage with plans for three team groups abandoned. Where are we going to get the time to watch 104 games?
It's going to be difficult, but I think everyone's already trying to work out how they can fiddle work and time off. Yeah. And I mean, it is mad. I mean, you're absolutely right in saying that on the back of a Winter World Cup in Qatar at the end of 2022, and now we're building obviously towards the Euros, which are going to be next summer, the Women's World Cup this summer. There's a huge amount of football to be played and not an enormous amount of time to play it in. The numbers that you rattle off there are absolutely right. And reflect the situation that the games are just being ramped up and ramped up. And I think from a fan perspective, obviously, the more football, the better. Everyone looks forward to football, and there'll be not the level of controversy surrounding this World Cup as there was surrounding the last World Cup. But players, players' unions, player welfare, clubs, club managers, and supporters who, let's be honest, care far more about club than country, won't be happy with it because it's lumping yet more games into a really, really busy schedule. It'll get kicked down the road a little bit now because obviously it's not until the summer of 2024, but it's a huge amount of football. It's very easy to kind of get torn because obviously it's exciting. It's a World Cup. It's being played in North America. But this is a huge change. Is it for the best? I don't really know at this stage.
Yeah, it's. I guess, look, we probably won't know until we're in it because you just don't know how things are going to play out. But it does feel like sometimes less is more. And in this case, you know, when you're trying to put so much demands on everybody, even on fans as well, like, you know, it just feels like they're just trying to have everything. And that... It just doesn't feel like it's going to be as good a quality as it has been in the past. But I mean, if Ireland get there or whatever, it's going to be, I'll be saying, isn't this a great World Cup? And isn't it brilliant to have all these teams? So, well, look, we'll leave that for now because we do have more live football tonight. We have the Champions League, which we love giving out about as well. But at the same time, it is brilliant. Manchester City, we've heard Pep during the week talking about how, or over the last couple of days, talking about how he's going to be judged on Europe. Every game for them in Europe, it does feel huge. It feels like the pressure is always on Pep in Europe. But look, tonight should be fairly straightforward for him.
It should. But he's absolutely right in this sense that his legacy at Manchester City will be judged by their performances in the Champions League. And just one final appearance under him tells that story. And he knows exactly the situation. They've been a dominant team in the Premier League. He's transformed them in that respect. But it's a huge gap in their trophy cabinet with no Champions League, particularly Liverpool winning whilst Pep Guardiola's been there, and obviously Real Madrid have been so superb. And he knows this. And I think tonight, I think they will get through. I wouldn't be expecting a 3-4 goal stroll because Leipzig showed in the first leg that they are a very good team and they're happy to just wait it out and wait for their chance to come. But I still don't see Man City massively changed in the last 12 months. I know obviously Erling Haaland has come in and he's scoring goals for fun, but the issues that Manchester City have at the real business end of the Champions League, personally, I don't think they've been solved. And when you look at Real Madrid against Liverpool in the first leg, Bayern Munich over two legs, brilliant, just ruthless, experienced, organised, confident. I don't really see Manchester City ticking those four boxes. I think they will get through tonight, which is a shame because Leipzig are a very good team, but you'd expect City to have a bit too much. But in terms of winning the trophy as it stands, no, I don't think they're any closer.
Okay, so the starting 11 for Man City has been announced. Ederson, Stones, Akanji, Diaz, Ake, Rodrigo, De Bruyne, Gundogan, Bernardo, Grealish and Haaland. Look, Haaland's there anyway, so I mean, when you look at a team like that, no matter who's in it or who's not in it, they're so impressive. And you just look at Pep now and say, you can't really mess this up, Pep. Look at the players that you have, and no doubt you'll have them really fired up as well, Fergal.
Yeah, and I mean, it wouldn't be a Pep Guardiola Manchester City Champions League knockout game with a bit of a wild card in a starting lineup. John Stones probably at right back. But the goals that they've got in that team, particularly not just through Haaland, but the creativity of Silva and Grealish and Gundogan can get an important goal. Kevin De Bruyne, I know he's been talking about him getting back to basics and doing the simple things right. He's still one of the best midfielders in world football. So
why do you think he said that?
As I say,
about De Bruyne,
I think it's a. I think it's a case of De Bruyne, going back to the subject of player welfare and the amount of games, De Bruyne has been quite vocal about this, and he's a player that's now the other side of 30. He's been fantastic for Man City, played a lot of games at a real high velocity, the way that he plays the game. And I think when it was clicking so well between him and Haaland at the start of the season, that De Bruyne pass, that Haaland run and that Man City goal, when that started to slow down a little bit, there was more focus on De Bruyne rather than Haaland, because Haaland was still knocking in goals through other routes. But I mean, I don't see it being any more than just a case of getting back to full fitness, getting back to full form, because he is brilliant. But I think Kevin De Bruyne, obviously because of his age, his position, he's not going to be as around as long as Erling Haaland. And I think we are starting to see him moving into maybe a different role. We've seen this with loads of midfielders over the years. You look at Real Madrid with Kroos and Modric and the way that they've adapted and changed. I think we will see that from De Bruyne in the next 12 to 18 months. But tonight should be, and I'm saying should be, pretty straightforward. But there's big tests for them in the rest of the season, and they've still got ground to make up on Arsenal in the Premier League.
Okay, that City RB Leipzig game is on RTE2 television. And just before we finish up, Fergal, a quick prediction on the other game tonight, which is FC Porto, Inter Milan. Inter Milan leading 1-0 on aggregate.
I fancy Porto to do this. I think Inter a bit disillusioned because they're trailing Napoli by so much in Serie A, and Porto got a good record at being quite a solid quarter-final team, good experience in the side. At home, they've only got one goal to level it up and then go and win it. I've got a feeling that they could do it. But in terms of not the same as Man City, but for different reasons, I don't see Porto going much further than that. But I think Inter have been kind of shaken by how good Napoli have been, and this could be another blow for them tonight.
Okay, Fergal Brennan, thank you so much for joining us. That is all we have time for this evening.